Matt Whitaker, former U.S. Acting Attorney General.
This is such a great conversation about America, our future, what's going to save our republic.
We have a great football player. Matt Whitaker is here. Matt.
They tried to bury me. They didn't realize I was a C.
It's a touchdown. Whitaker.
Former acting U.S. Attorney General.
Under President Trump.
I'm going to be an unwavering supporter of law enforcement.
Welcome to Liberty and Justice with your host, Matt Whitaker.
Welcome to Liberty and Justice. I'm your host, Matt Whitaker. This episode is presented by the American Cornerstone Institute. It's good to be with you today. It's another great week. And I think one of the big things that's been in the news has been this whole TikTok bill that got passed out of the House by an overwhelming bipartisan majority. And so I have asked someone that I think is going to be able to help us all understand this bill and its ramifications better, Rachel Bovard. Rachel, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Rachel's at CPI for those DC insiders, otherwise known as the Conservative Partnership Institute. She was formerly spent a year at the Republican Steering Committee. Is that right? In the Senate?
That's right.
That's run by my friend Mike Lee, who tried to adopt my hairstyle and just couldn't pull it off. I told him that to his face, so I can say that here on Liberty and Justice. But why don't you just like set the table here, Rachel? The House did pass the TikTok bill, and you know, we're now the Senate is may or may not take it up. So why don't you tell us what's in the bill, maybe some of the great things about it, and then some of the criticisms and why those criticisms maybe aren't as fair as they might appear.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, the House did pass overwhelmingly this bill, which, you know, is being portrayed in the media as a TikTok ban, but what it really does is force a divestiture of TikTok from its Chinese parent company, ByteDance. So it says, if you are still going to be owned by China and ByteDance, you cannot operate in the United States. However, if you spin off as an independent company, then there's no problem. You know, TikTok will continue to exist. And why that's important, I think, is for people to understand is the way China treats its companies. There are no private companies in China. And this is true not only of companies run by Chinese citizens, but companies run by anyone else that exists in China. There was passed what they call a national security law in China, essentially allowing any company that operates within its borders. The Chinese government is forced these companies to have a backdoor into their IP, into their user base, into all the data collected there. So there is actually concern, which I think is warranted, that the Chinese government has backdoor access to all of the data that TikTok collects and any company operating within inside China, including Apple, including a number of American companies have granted the Chinese government that power because they have to if they want to operate in China. So this bill is seeking to address specifically that issue being raised as a national security threat.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, sort of if you've ever been on TikTok, which I've gone on their website and it's a little frightening and it's addicting for our, you know, for young kids and the type of information that ultimately, it can, harvest, mostly, you know, not only private data, but the terms of use, my recollection is it allows them to go beyond your use of the application and maybe even go into your use of your entire phone or computer.
That's right. And that is something that we have empirical proof of, right? That TikTok does. They track what's called off-app activity. So if you have TikTok downloaded on your phone, they are most likely tracking your keystrokes in other apps. They're tracking your activity. They're tracking your phone calls. We know they create voice and facial profiles, which we call biometric data on individuals. And, you know, this is not to say other companies don't do this, right? We know that Facebook and Google collect a ton of off-platform data as well. But I think an issue comes up when this data in particular is sitting with a hostile foreign adversary, especially on a platform that's as popular as TikTok, as you point out, as addicting as TikTok. TikTok's algorithm is superior, frankly. And that's what gives it its addictive qualities is people, you know, you saw kids calling into Congress admitting they spend 9 hours a day on this thing. Imagine yeah. What the Chinese government can do with that kind of access.
Well, correct. And I mean, this is, you know, terms of use are a whole different probably topic that if we have time at the end, we could get into because you point out that the amount of data that's being collected on American citizens is second to none. And then in the hands of a surveillance state that aggregates data, builds data profiles, it's really quite extraordinary. You know, I had a chance recently to sit down with Jordan Peterson, Dr. Jordan Peterson, who's you know, kind of got some ideas in this space and was talking just about how, you know, we have our kind of the real you, and then you have the online version of you that probably these marketers like Google, you know, TikTok and others have built that might know more about you than you do. I mean, they've pointed to an example where at least one of these massive tech companies was able to predict a woman was pregnant before she even knew she was pregnant. So, I mean, talk to me a little bit about, you know, kind of the broader concern of sort of data privacy. I mean, I understand that China's evil, and I believe that, and they are not our friend and ally. They are an adversary for sure, and there's no way we should allow American citizens' private data or computer usage or anything else to be owned at that, you know, on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. But talk to me a little bit more generally about, you know, privacy data and consumer data and just how it's almost weaponized against American citizens. I know that term's overused, but...
No, I mean, it's an accurate statement, especially after we know from the Edward Snowden leaks that, you know, the PRISM program run by the National Security Administration was doing exactly this. They were getting backdoor access to Facebook, Google, Dropbox, all these companies to collect this kind of data, because the companies use this, right? The data is their currency, for lack of a better term. This is what fuels their platform. We ourselves are the product. And so by using these platforms, we click through all these consent agreements, basically allowing them to harvest everything we do. And as I was mentioning earlier, we allow them to track us offline. If we're not using Facebook on our phone, Facebook is following us around our phone. They know what we're doing. They know what we're doing online. And all of that consumer tracking is fed into these companies. It creates their advertising revenue, essentially. It allows them to micro-target us, right, with ads. And to your example, that's how they know a woman is pregnant before she does, because they'll know she's doing certain things, tracking certain cycles, all these things. It puts all of this into a category, and that's your user-generated profile. And they will then sell that data sometimes, right? Sometimes it feeds their own algorithm, and sometimes they sell it to advertisers. And so it really is this micro-targeting is the business model of these companies. And you can maybe make a consumer case for it, but the government also knows this exists. And the government loves to have access to it. And the really scary thing is that there's a whole third-party market for this data, which, you know, companies will sell it to, you know, data brokers and all these other entities. Well, the government can purchase that data too. And that is an open subversion of your Fourth Amendment right. Against, you know, search and seizure by the government. They don't have to get a warrant to get that data. And so that's another loophole, right, that we have as we develop these technologies. The government exploits them as well as everyone else.
Yeah, and kind of subsumed in that category of data you're talking about is the location data, which, you know, I don't know if many Americans have dug into sort of what that is or what that isn't, but the long story short is everywhere that you go with your cell phone, it leaves a trail. And so you can, you know, marry some of this data together, see who goes to a concert, see those 10,000 phones at a concert, and then see where they go to sleep at night. It's really, I've seen a demonstration on it. It is quite frightening. And, you know, the challenge is if you turn it off, then you can't use the navigational maps on your phone to find your way to lunch. And so how is there first of all, talk about location data, and then I'd like to pivot into sort of what is a regulatory scheme that allows sort of us to leverage technology to improve our lives. And so there's no doubt that having directions be read to you turn by turn is very, you know, helpful to live in your everyday. But like, talk a little bit about location data, then plus, like, what is the regulatory scheme that maybe, in addition to making TikTok not be owned by a foreign adversary, what other policies or prescriptions could we find?
Yeah, the geolocation data is a great point, because your cell phone is physically involved in that as well. So on Google phones in particular, on Android phones, even if your cell phone is off, you've turned it off, it is still tracking your movement based on like physical characteristics of the phone, so that when you turn that phone back on, all of that geolocation tracking data gets uploaded into the Google Cloud, even though you thought, right, I'm turning off my phone, so it's not happening. So that it was interesting during the COVID-19 pandemic, Google demonstrated how effective that geolocation tracking data was because it would put out using user location data that it collected, it would put out heat maps of where people were going. And it was showing, oh, you know, this place is locked down, but look at all these people that still went to the park, right? And that was really when you started to see the nefarious side of this, which was very concerning.
Incredibly concerning.
And I think that that gets to the real concern about what these companies are doing with the data, because you're right, there is no regulatory framework for this. There really aren't a ton of laws around this. We do have consumer privacy laws and things like that, but they haven't caught up. They don't move at the pace of innovation. And that's the American design, right? Our laws are always chasing innovation, and that's what makes our country kind of awesome, because you can always push the envelope. But at some point, the government has to say, well, you know, the policymakers in particular have to say that we have a compelling interest in making sure, one, this data doesn't end up in the improper hands, which is kind of the genesis behind this TikTok bill. Mm-hmm. But two, I think policymakers really need to take a hard look at who is using this data for what purpose, and does it need to be a little bit more constrained? Because to the point that you made earlier, we've already seen private companies be able to, using geolocation data and other third-party data publicly available, piece together where people are going and for what purpose, and use it to like out them, you know, make claims, wild claims about them in the press. Mm-hmm. And so I think of concern to me personally is, and I think should be the priority, the government accessing this data in a way that subverts your constitutional rights. Like, it's one thing for us to be debating the Chinese government not having access to the data, but what about our own government? Right? What rules of the road should be in place for this? And there are bills that do exist to control the government's access to the third-party data. Say you cannot the government is prohibited from purchasing this data. If they want to know about you, they have to go through the Constitution. And that seems to me to be a baseline.
There's a novel idea, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Like a baseline start to this debate.
Right.
Right. So.
Well, so let's look into the crystal ball. This TikTok bill passed overwhelming majorities on both sides. In spite of some high-profile opponents to it, I mean, kind of like dig into the bill. What does it do? Does it make Donald Trump divest of truth when his opponent declares him to be a Russian asset? Is it that insidious, or does it actually work to make sure that China has to not have anything to do with TikTok, so it's not undermining our society?
Yeah, so I'm actually less concerned about this bill, I think, than some, because there are very aggressive TikTok bills. The Restrict Act, which some of you may recall, it was introduced maybe 6 or 7 months ago. That was a wild overreach that gave the national security state tremendous authority to do kind of exactly what you're suggesting. This bill is not the Restrict Act. It does give the president some authority to declare a platform, a foreign adversary, but it's very carefully cabined. It has to have at least 20% foreign ownership by a specific set of countries. And those countries are already defined in U.S. code as North Korea, Iran, China, and Russia. And that's already settled law. And so it is very carefully cabined. The enforcement authority is given to the attorney general to go after companies for data misuse, subject to specific definitions. Say you can only go after companies, again, that are from foreign owned by these countries. And also you can't go after the users. You're just going after the company. So I do see the concern being raised, is this sufficient control? Because we've seen the government, take a provision and ignore it, or take a provision and assign itself more authority than what's in the statute. So I do think that this bill should have received more debate than it did. We saw it suddenly pop up and move through the House extremely quickly. So I'm hoping if it does come up in the Senate, that we do take time to hash out these issues, because these are important. But the way I read it, it doesn't pose an existential threat to platforms like X or Rumble, who wouldn't even apply to the definitions of this bill.
Right. You mentioned something that is, I'm going to ask an inartful question. You're going to have to make me look smart here. The algorithm, you said the TikTok algorithm is very good, which means essentially it feeds users what they're interested in. It sees how long you dwell on a particular short video, and then starts, finds ways to give you more of that, to capture your attention, because that's the game is all about, the capture of attention. What happens as AI continues to develop and these algorithms get smarter and smarter? what happens to individual liberty and the ability to find our own experience as human beings instead of being led around by our nose by, quite frankly, things that are smarter than us?
Right. Now, that is the foundational question, I think, that's plagued us since technology sort of moved into this realm, yeah. Right? It's a chicken and egg question at some point. Are you making an independent decision, or is the algorithm making you think you're making an independent decision? And, you know, I think what's really scary about it, too, is that, you know, the algorithms have, they're trained by the people who program them, but they're trained by our own behavior. Mm-hmm. So the algorithm also knows when, you know, your defenses are down. If you're scrolling on your phone at 2 a.m., Instagram knows that's a great time to push you targeted ads because, you know, you're sleep deprived and
emotional. That's why I bought my last set of golf clubs. I mean, I was in a weak moment.
Right. No, exactly. So, you know, that is something I think we haven't as a country talked enough about because we tend to look at innovation as a good full stop. We don't talk about the consequences of how it makes us as a country, how it changes us as humans. And so this is it's a sort of philosophical but very important discussion I think we have to have when we think about how we want to live with these technologies, because that's the foundational policy question, right? How do we as a country decide we want to live in relation to these platforms? And we are just scratching the surface of that conversation now.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't feel like that conversation is happening enough. And these kind of what is or what isn't, this data, who owns it, how can it be used, you know, how can AI and algorithms and all, just nobody is having smart discussions, at least enough that it's breaking through to, you know, citizens. Because again, remember, we are a constitutional republic that the people are sovereign, and the people, you know, are again, have not received enough information on kind of what this is. And it's hard. I mean, because of the addictive nature and how insidious things like TikTok, you know, I mean, Instagram, all the things that gather our attention. It's just, I mean, parents pretty oftentimes just throw up their hands. I mean, as soon as you give a child a phone, I mean, you pretty much have handed them over to big tech. And that's, you know, with very little ability to, you know, to regulate what they're doing on those platforms.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I hear that conversation a lot with people that are like, well, if you don't want your kid to be addicted to TikTok, keep them away from technology. And to some extent, it's a losing battle because this isn't like a video game, right? You know, if you buy a video game, you bring it into your house, you're opening your house up to certain things. If you allow the internet in your home, you're letting in the world. And that really isn't a choice at this point, right? Like we transact online, we bank online, our lives are online.
You and I are talking online.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we're also in a situation where you send your 6-year-old to kindergarten, the first thing your school does is hand them a Chromebook, right? Which Google has given to every school for free because they're so benevolent. But what they're actually doing is they're clientizing your child. They're getting them used to Google services and products. They're very often signing them up for YouTube. And the parental controls are weak and almost non-existent. And so we're not, the analogy of just like, well, just take away the phone doesn't really fit into modern life. Mm-hmm. So I do think that these conversations need further development. And it's not as simple as to say, well, just don't give your kid a phone. Yes, that's certainly part of it, right? But it's broader than that.
Well, and Rachel, in the last few minutes we have, I guess one of the things I'm always, you know, suspicious of is, you know, when the talk of let's regulate big tech, you know, and Mark Zuckerberg and others are like begging Congress to pass a regulatory scheme, is that they're doing that to try to protect their monopoly or their franchise and trying to, you know, limit innovation and limit the next kind of big idea because they can afford more lawyers, they can afford more lobbyists. And so how do we draw that line? How do we make sure we're not, you know, protecting sort of these big big tech companies like Google, Facebook, and others, and at the same time, you know, foster innovation and protect the American citizens from, you know, these manipulations of their time, attention, and you know, sort of human beingness.
Yeah, so I think a first good rule of thumb is that anything the companies propose about regulation, ignore it, because as you point out, it's incumbent protection. But the second thing, you know, that I've spent a lot of time thinking about is protecting the competitive markets in this space. Because a lot of times what we're seeing is the threat from big tech existing at the level it does because of the scale of these companies. Mm-hmm. These companies have unprecedented reach. We've never seen this in modern or in any part of human history. Google literally filters information for 90% of the world. It has 90% market share. So the narrative that Google chooses to set changes minds and opinions in the entire world. There's never been a company more dominant than that. And so I do think that we focus a lot on the speech question, on the free speech issues, which are all valid, but they're downstream of these companies' abilities to be so dominant in the spaces that they're in. So I do think that the market power question has to be addressed in some ways. Mm-hmm. You know, narrowly, this gets to the question of, is Google a monopoly? The Department of Justice, this started under the Trump DOJ. It's been continued by the Biden DOJ, basically saying, we're pursuing that question in the courts, right? But I do think, you know, the more speech platforms we have in this space, the better. But unfortunately, there are barriers to that. We saw that with Parler. This, I think, is the classic example. When Parler was the most popular speech app in the App Store, and it was just brutally kneecapped out of existence by sort of an ideologically collusive effort between the hosting companies and the app stores and all this stuff. So we need to address those market barriers to entry, because I do still believe fundamentally that competition solves these problems, but we don't have enough competition in this space. So I think the market power question has to be addressed before anything else.
I think we solve
speech problems that way, frankly.
Again, it's all about the marketplace of ideas. And you know, and like to your point, that's how it's going to, you keep it competitive and you don't allow one person to control. Because we saw with Google's, was it Claude, their AI, and whatever was producing the images that were just inconsistent with reality, how much they had tried to inculcate their woke ideology both into their artificial intelligence and obviously into their search as well, that we can infer that is that. And so that is a big concern, no doubt.
Yeah. And we're seeing it from other AIs too. You had Google Gemini, but Adobe is recently coming out, and it's the same problem, right? Because the same sort of woke tech engineers are all working on the same product. Yeah.
And doesn't it seem like, I know I keep saying we're almost done, but then you say something that just like triggers another interesting thought is, you know, I mean, Musk seems to be the one that is sort of on the side of what we're talking about, which is sort of the freedom of the individual, the non woke ideology being, you know, thrust through technology, and having the marketplace of ideas where the solution for speech you don't like is more speech, not, you know, trying to regulate, you know, speech that you disagree with.
Yeah. No, Musk, you know, buying Twitter, I think it was a game changer in this entire debate. I don't think it's the solution for everything, right? We can't, we don't have enough billionaires, I think, to step in and solve this problem. But I do think he's demonstrating, you know, how well, and the fundamental and foundational idea of America, which to your point is, if you don't, the answer to speech you don't like is not cracking down on it, it's actually more speech. And I think the more of those market forces you can infuse into this space, the better. But I think it's going to take structural change, and it's going to take our policymakers and regulators looking at the space and saying, how do we protect a vibrant and dynamic market rather than this, for a better lack of a better term, you know, speech cartel that we currently have?
Yeah. Well, Rachel Barvard, we'll have to leave it at that. Thank you so much. Is there a place that people can follow what you're doing or what you're talking about?
Yep. You can follow, you can get my bio and all my background at cpi.org. And then also I'm on Twitter at Rachel Bovard. I'm on X at Rachel Bovard.
All right. Well, Twitter, X, whatever. It's always going to be Twitter, those that have been on it for over a decade.
But, it's true.
All right. Well, Rachel, thank you so much. I appreciate everybody tuning in. It's a great discussion with somebody that's like thinking about these important issues and fighting for the things that we believe in. So remember, everything I'm doing, whether it's Liberty and Justice, whether it's my TV hits or anything else, you can find me at whitaker.tv. Until next week, thanks for tuning in to Liberty and Justice.
Liberty and Justice.